Disc 6.
The naval bombardment lifted precisely at 8:57 a.m. At 9:02, just 120 seconds behind a schedule that had kicked in at Hawaii, the first wave, armored tractors, each mounted with a 75-millimeter cannon, lumbered from the waves onto the soft black sands of Iwo Jima. The first troop carrying Amtraks landed 3 minutes later at 9:05 a.m., and behind them came hundreds more, each trailing a white wake. Easy Company rolled in on the 12th wave at 9:55 a.m. Easy was part of Harry the Horse's 28th Regiment, whose special mission was to land on Green Beach 1, the stretch nearest Mount Suribachi, just 400 yards away on the left, and then form a ribbon of men across the narrow neck of the island, isolating the fortified mountain and ultimately capturing it. This assignment meant that Easy Company would be part of a 2,000-man force fighting a separate battle from the main assault. Some of the 5th and the entire 4th Division would fan out toward the right and progress northward along the island's length to engage the bulk of its defenders. Before the battle ended, part of the 3rd Division, originally seen as a reserve force, would be rushed into action. The 28th's was no small mission. As Howland Mad Smith would later declare, "The success of our entire assault depended upon the early capture of that grim, smoking rock." And so the great tragic funneling from wide ocean to narrow beach had begun. Hordes of wet, equipment-burdened boys slogging from the water, forming a tightly packed mass on the 2-mile strip of beach, targets in a shooting gallery. The boys squinted upward at their assigned routes and the ugly, stunted mountain beyond. The beach slanted upward from a point some 30 yards from the edge of the surf. It rose in 3 terraces, each about 8 feet high and 16 feet apart. In peaceful times, it might have resembled a gently curving amphitheater. In this context, it was an amphitheater of death. The boys would have to climb not on hard white sand, but on soft black volcanic ash that gave way and made each upward step a lingering effort. The first wave of Marines and armored vehicles hit the shores. The vehicles bogged down immediately in the absorbent maw. The troops moved around them and began their cautious climb, unshielded up the terraces. It was all so quiet at first. Perhaps the optimistic young Marines had been right. Perhaps it was over already. Donald Howell recalled, "When the landing gate dropped, I just walked onto the beach. I was confident. Everyone was milling around. I thought this would be a cinch." The cinch lasted about an hour. The false calm was part of General Kurabashi's radical strategy to hold off from firing at once, as every other Japanese force had done in the island campaign, and wait until the funneling attackers had filled the beach. Easy Company had been ashore some 20 minutes and in their assembly area when the slaughter began. Smoke, an ear-splitting noise, suddenly filled the universe. The almost unnoticed blockhouses on the flat ground facing the ocean began raking the exposed troops with machine gun bullets, but the real firestorm erupted from the mountain, from Suribachi. Mortars, heavy artillery shells, and machine gun rounds ripped into the stunned Americans. 2,000 hidden Japanese were gunning them down, with everything from rifles to coastal defense guns. "It was so loud, it was almost like it was quiet," one stunned Marine remembered. To Lieutenant Keith Wells, Doc's 3rd platoon leader, Suribachi turned into a monstrous Christmas tree with blinking lights. The lights were gun barrels discharging ammunition at him and his men. There was no protection. Now the mortars and bullets were tearing in from all over the island. General Kurabayashi had designed an elaborate crossfire from other units to the north. Entire platoons were engulfed in fireballs. Boys clawed frantically at the soft ash, trying to dig holes, but the ash filled in each swipe of the hand or shovel. Heavy rounds sent jeeps and armored tractors spinning into the air in fragments. Some Marines hit by these rounds were not just killed. Their bodies ceased to exist. "More than Marines. I was watching an Amtrak to the side of us as we went in," Robert Leader remembers. "Then there was this enormous blast, and it disappeared. I looked for wreckage and survivors, but nothing. I couldn't believe it. Everything just vaporized. In the same boat with Leader was Doc Bradley. The boys on the beach scrambled forward. It was like walking through a pile of shell corn, said one. Like climbing in talcum powder, said another. Like a bin of wheat, like deep snow. Advancing tanks crushed those of the wounded who could not get out of the way. Others, unwounded, were shoved to their deaths by those behind them. More and more boats kept landing with more guys coming onto the beach, said Guy Castorini. You had to just push the guy in front of you. It was like pushing him to his death. The shock of actual combat triggered bizarre thoughts and behavior. Some Marines dropped into a deep, terror-induced sleep amid the carnage and had to be kicked awake by their officers. Others clung to fastidious habits of civilian life. I don't smoke, moaned a badly wounded boy who'd been offered a lit cigarette. Jim Buchanan, who had hoped there would be some Japanese left for him, became indignant when he realized what was happening. Did you see those Japanese firing at us? He screamed to the guy next to him. No, the leatherneck answered, deadpan. Did you shoot them? Gee, no, Buchanan replied. That didn't occur to me. I've never been shot at before. Phil Ward, leaping out of the Amtrak that also contained my father, had a similar epiphany. We'd had live ammo training in Hawaii, so I was used to the sound of bullets, but suddenly I realized why this was different. God damn, I said. These people are shooting at me. The beach rapidly turned into a salvage yard of wrecked trucks and jeeps stuck in the sand or smashed by artillery. The dead piled up along the shoreline. Coming in, I could see the guys lying on the beach, Corman Roy Steinfort recalled. I thought, great, they'll cover our landing. But when we drew closer, I saw they were all dead. Annihilation seemed possible in the hideous first minutes. Radio transmissions back to command quarters aboard the ships raised that specter. Catching all hell from the quarry, heavy mortar and machine gun fire, taking heavy casualties and can't move for the moment, mortars killing us. All units pinned down by artillery and mortars, casualties heavy, need tank support fast to move anywhere. Taking heavy fire and forward movement stopped, machine gun and artillery fire heaviest ever seen. But it was even worse than what the transmissions indicated. No one was out of danger. A 5'3" Associated Press photographer named Joe Rosenthal, landing with the 4th Division, ran for his life through the hail of bullets. Later he would declare that not getting hit was like running through rain and not getting wet. Corpsman Greg Emery, crawling on all fours, glanced back at a landing craft coming in. The ramp dropped down, machine gun fire ripped the interior, boys fell dead atop each other as they stumbled off the ramp. The first wave of Easy Company Marines caught on the terraces in their heavy packs scrambled for survival. Like climbing a waterfall, one remembered. Jerry Smith pressed himself as close to the ground as he could and felt bullets rip through his backpack. Even the socks in my pack had bullet holes in them, he recalls. The volcanic ash slowed progress and kept the Marines exposed to fire, but in another sense the ash saved lives. It absorbed many of the mortar rounds and shrapnel, muffling explosions and sucking in the lethal fragments. Lieutenant Ed Pinnell's 2nd Platoon nearly lost its way in these early moments of deafening chaos. The unit, with Mike as squad leader and Harlan, Franklin, and Ira in the ranks, landed far off course, north of Green Beach. Shortly after the bombardment erupted, Harry the Horse summoned Easy Company Captain Dave Severance and ordered him to stand by. Are you ready to move out? Liversedge demanded. All except the 2nd Platoon that hasn't arrived yet, sir, Severance replied. Well, you've got 5 minutes to find that platoon or you're up for a general court-martial, the colonel retorted. The platoon soon rejoined the company. Its wayward landing down the beach had touched off a comic moment before the carnage. Lieutenant Pinnell had thought to reorient his men with a show of John Wayne-like gallantry. As the Amtrak's ramp went down, he yelled, "Come on, men!" and then fell flat on his face into the water-saturated volcanic ash. The guys ran up my back laughing, he remembered. Not everyone was laughing. I was a very scared son of a gun, Ira wrote later. Our boat hit solid ground and the ramp went down. I jumped clear of the ramp. About 3 yards away lay a dead Marine right on the water's edge, shot in the head. he hadn't begun to fight. My stomach turned flip-flops, and I started to get scared all over again. A tissue of their former lives connected many of the onrushing warriors. Ironies, coincidences of place and memory, overlapping fragments of their boyhoods. Wesley Kuhn of Black Creek, Wisconsin, was 19 years old when he hit the beach. Wesley did not know Doc Bradley, who could not have been more than a few dozen yards away, but he knew Doc's future wife, Betty Van Gorp. Wesley and Betty had been in a school play together in the 9th grade. Wesley's role had been that of the kissing bandit, who'd snuck up and planted a kiss on Betty, who was playing an innocent housewife. Bodies, body parts, everywhere he looked, recalled Kuhn. My worst memory is of the first time I saw a man with his chest blown open and dirt trickling in on his vital organs. There were moments of grotesque humor. Monroe Osment of Virginia and his buddies were struggling up and over the third terrace, getting picked off by machine gun and mortar fire when someone yelled, "Turner got hit!" Turner was a heavyset guy, Osment remembered, and we always kidded him that if he got hit, he'd get it in the butt. "Where'd he get hit?" I shouted, and someone yelled back, "In the butt!" But there were many more moments of unbearable pathos. 19-year-old corpsman Danny Thomas hit the beach at 10:15 a.m., several paces behind his best buddy, Chick Harris. In training camp, Thomas and Harris were called the Buttermilk Boys because they were too young to buy drinks on Liberty. "I was charging ahead and saw Chick on the beach, facing out to sea, his back to the battle," Thomas recalled. His buddy was in a strange posture. His head and torso were erect, as though he'd let himself be buried in the sand from the waist down in some bizarre prank. As Thomas rushed past him, he yelled a greeting and saw Chick's hand and eyes move, acknowledging him. Then Thomas glimpsed something else that made him fall to his knees in the sand, vomiting. The something else was blood and entrails. "I vomited my toenails out," Thomas remembered. "I realized that Chick had been cut in two. The lower half of his body was gone." He added, "He was the first person I ever saw dead. Buttermilk Chick was 15. He had lied about his age to get into the Marines." The big shells had blown a few holes in the ash. Guy Castorini and a few other rookies were in one behind their leader, a veteran named Lunsford. "We had no idea if this was a bad battle or not." One of the guys yelled, "Hey, Lunsford, is this a bad battle?" Lunsford shouted back, "It's a fucking slaughter!" Maybe 2 minutes later, whoom, we got hit with a mortar. I ducked and something dropped on my back and rolled off. It felt like a coconut or something. I looked down and saw that it was Lunsford's head. Those were his last words. A fucking slaughter. Somehow the Marines kept advancing. Somehow discipline held. Somehow valor overcame terror. Somehow scared young men under sheets of deadly fire kept on doing the basic gritty tasks necessary to keep the invasion going. The calming presence of veterans in their midst was one factor in their resolve. Another was their year of advanced Marine training in the California and Hawaii camps. "Our training taught us how to conquer fear," was the way Corpsman Langley put it. We knew there was a good possibility that we would die or get wounded, but we knew we had to keep going to keep from getting killed. You learn there's an awful lot you can do while having the hell scared out of you. Mike Strank, true to form, was one of the steadying veterans. In the opening moments of Japanese mortar fire, when the boys of Easy Company were still groping their way toward Captain Severance's main unit, Lloyd Thompson looked up to his right and could not believe what he saw. There was Mike, sitting upright, emptying the sand out of his boots, just as if nothing was happening. Bill Rannis remembers the same sight. "I had my face buried in the sand. I looked up and saw Mike sitting straight up, emptying his shoes." What a guy! Having made his point, Mike was soon shepherding his boys across the sands to their rendezvous with Dave Severance's unit. Joe Rodriguez remembers him dashing back and forth among his squad members, cautioning them to spread out. "Don't bunch up. Don't be like a bunch of bananas." It was gestures such as Mike's, probably hundreds of them, most lost to history, that enabled the Americans to withstand the maelstrom of hidden firepower and even to begin inflicting damage of their own. Damage against what? That was the constant question at Iwo Jima. There were no targets. The gunners were invisible, protected, creatures of the underworld. Sergeant Major Lindolf Ward summed up the frustration. The thing that bothered me was you couldn't get your licks in. There was no visible enemy to shoot at. Even when they claimed a casualty, the Marines could rarely see it. The Japanese quickly pulled their dead and wounded back inside the caves and blockhouses. Thus, there was little evidence of the invasion's impact, a detriment to morale. In the days that followed, observers of the battle in spotter planes high above the action would remark that it looked as though the Marines were fighting the island itself. And yet the Americans did inflict damage that hellish first morning by the same excruciating means they would continue to inflict it for 36 days until all the 22,000 defenders were wiped out. By exposing themselves to fire, charging the fortified blockhouses and cave entrances, and shooting or incinerating their tormentors at close range. One of their strategies was to identify fire lanes. By observing where enemy machine gun bullets were landing and kicking up ash, a Marine could roughly judge the peripheral limits of a shooter's range, his capacity to swivel a gun left and right from inside his cave or blockhouse. Units of boys, widely spaced, would dash along the outer boundaries of those fire lanes, a great many of them falling dead or wounded under crossfire, until a survivor reached the cave's mouth or the blockhouse's unprotected rear. Then a tossed grenade, an orange sheet from a flamethrower, and the nest was silent. For a while. An early mistake in the invasion was to assume that a source of enemy fire once extinguished was permanently dead. It wasn't. General Kurabayashi's vast tunneling system assured that many Marines were shot as they moved past a neutralized nest that had been quickly repopulated from below the ground. Throughout the bloody morning, fresh troops landed on the beaches. Tangible progress was achieved in the opening hour and a half of combat. By 10:35 a.m., a small group of men from the first assault waves, Company A of the 28th Regiment, had survived a near-suicidal 700-yard dash across the island to the western beach. Already Suribachi was cut off from the rest of the island. The reptile's head was alive and deadly, but it had been severed. How they got there was a portrait of American victory in microcosm. They got there with courage best exemplified by Tony Stein's headlong charge. Stein was a 23-year-old corporal from Dayton who became the first Medal of Honor winner on Iwo. For the risky mission, he'd armed himself with a Stinger gun, a light machine gun he'd taken from an airplane, and adapted into a rapid-fire gun. When his comrades were stalled on their dash by concentrated Japanese fire, Stein stood upright, drawing the enemy's fire and allowing his buddies to get into position. But Stein was just getting warmed up. His next move was to charge the nearby Japanese pillboxes alone. He did this several times, killing 20 of the enemy in close-range combat. Out of ammunition, he threw off his helmet and shoes and hurried barefoot to the beach to resupply himself. He did this 8 times, carrying a wounded man to safety on each trip. Later in the day, he covered the withdrawal of his platoon to the company position, though his weapon was shot from his hands 2 times. Meanwhile, other brave boys were doing grunt work near the shoreline, work that would get the mechanized part of the assault in motion. Oblivious to the storm of lead and steel, some bent down and shoved wire mats under the treads of mired tanks. Others calmly climbed into bulldozers to begin roughing out the semblance of a road system. These were the instincts of training and courage that took hold as the first shock of battle wore off. Courage fueled by a fierce kind of love. There was an incredible bond among guys on that beach, Danny Thomas remembered. We knew each other. And we could rely upon each other, trust one another. We had trained together and we were bonded. Death became demystified, an occupational hazard. The Marines quickly saw that even heroes could die. Sergeant John Bazalone, the Medal of Honor winner who had helped change the course of the Guadalcanal battle, was leading a rifle unit along the beach toward a Japanese emplacement. "Come on, you guys! We got to get these guns off the beach," he called to his men. And then was obliterated by a mortar shell. Moments of valor proliferated. Among the heroes were the men sent to give solace. Corman Emery yelled, "Keep down!" to a fellow medic sitting upright in the sand. Crawling closer, he saw that the man was struggling to tie a tourniquet around the stump of his leg. "Take care of the others. I'll be okay," the injured medic called out. When Emery crawled back past the corpsman several minutes later, he was dead. "Dead men were lying around," Ira said later, and the peculiar smell of gunpowder, smoke, and blood was in the air. Father Paul Bradley went in on the third wave. "I was young," he recalled later, "and didn't think about the danger to me. And I was too busy crawling from dying man to dying man. It was always, 'Father, over here!' Once I was kneeling in the sand administering to a guy who'd been hit. There was a loud thud. His eyes closed. He'd been hit again and was dead. 'Father, over here!' someone called. I went on to the next one." One combatant met his fate with supreme elegance. The moment occurred in the air as the first wave of Amtraks headed for shore. The Marine fighter planes were finishing up their low strafing runs, and as the last pilot began to pull his Corsair aloft, Japanese sprang to their guns and riddled the plane with flak. The pilot, Major Ray Dollins, tried to gain altitude as he headed out over the ocean so as to avoid a deadly crash into the Marines headed for the beach, but his plane was too badly damaged. Lieutenant Keith Wells watched it from his Amtrak, with Doc Bradley standing by his side. "We could see him in the cockpit," Wells said, "and he was trying everything. He was heading straight down for a group of approaching tracks filled with Marines. At the last second, he flipped the plane over on its back and aimed it into the water between two waves of tanks. We watched the water exploding into the air." Military personnel listening to the flight radio network from the ships could not only see Dollins go down, they could hear his last words into his microphone. They were a defiant parody. "Oh, what a beautiful morning! Oh, what a beautiful day! I've got a terrible feeling everything's coming my way." 8 days earlier, en route to Iwo Jima, Major Dollins had received news of the birth of his first child, a daughter. He was the first 5th Division Marine to die in the battle. In the midst of all this carnage and confusion was my father. My father, with his corpsman's pouch, his Unit 3 slung over his shoulder. The ex-paper boy on his rounds. He was busy almost from the moment he touched land, although his fellow medic Cliff Langley was busy even sooner. "Cliff hit the beach about 10 seconds before me," Doc told an interviewer some weeks after the battle, "and when I stepped out, he was already treating a casualty." The casualty was a lieutenant shot through the jaw, a disabling wound by its appearance. "Do you want to be evacuated?" Langley asked the man. "No, I'm okay, thanks," the Marine bravely mumbled, and ran back into the battle. Thurman Fogarty, 18 then, remembered the welter of blood that engulfed the Navy doctors and corpsmen as soon as they landed. Fogarty himself was buffeted by the concussions of the big shells coming in and going out, like gusts of a powerful wind. After just a few minutes, he fell to the beach and scraped out as much indentation as he could. Doc Bradley was crouched next to him, attending to a small wound in his own leg. "I happened to look to my left and saw that the Marine next to me had his arm almost blown off," Fogarty said. "It was just dangling from his shoulder. I pointed this out to Doc. He looked up from his own wounds and rolled across my legs to attend the injured Marine. The guy was conscious." Doc calmly put a tourniquet on the stump of the arm and told the guy to hold it. Then he shot him full of morphine and tied the dangling arm to the stump, and then pointed him toward the aid station. After that, Fogarty and my father were separated. Crawling up a terrace, Fogarty spotted a boy whose head had been cut open by shrapnel. The sight nauseated him, and he slid into a shell crater to vomit. There again he found Doc, taking care of a man whose chest had been caved in. This sight reactivated Fogarty's heaving. "Doc asked me where I was hit," he later remembered. "I told him I was just sick." He smiled at me and assured me, "You'll be all right." John Ferdadovich, also 18, would become Easy's first casualty and had need of Doc Bradley nearly as soon as he broke from the water. He recalled it vividly. "I heard the mortar, then I felt a cold chill, the shock to my nervous system as the shrapnel penetrated my arm and leg. I was sliced open from my knee to my buttocks and under my arm. My femur was smashed. Doc came over. He made everyone stay away. He was very forceful and took charge. Then he gave me blood transfusions as I went in and out of consciousness. Then four Marines carried me away to a place on the beach for evacuation. The place where Ferdadovich lay offered no protection from the hellstorm. Every inch of the beach was an active target. Ferdadovich lay on his cot until 4 p.m. and watched death and destruction explode around him. He saw a boatload of Marines lifted out of the water in a giant flash and implode into nothingness. He saw other wounded boys on their stretchers get blown to pieces. He saw kids in the beach detail get hit as they unloaded explosives, their flesh fused to the fireball. The sight that returned to the future teacher most often in memory, however, was a strikingly unlikely one, a glimpse of Harlan Block as Harlan ran past him toward the action. I called up to him. I said, "Hi," Ferdadovich remembered, but he just ran on by. It was the look in his eyes that startled me. He had a glazed, blank look. It was as if memories were coming back to him from past experiences. This surprised me. I later studied psychology, and I realized that those dilated pupils meant he was shocked by something and was transfixed on some image from his past. It was as if the noise of the mortars transported him to a past memory. Ferdadovich later decided that Harlan was summoning up visions of death, the deaths he'd seen on Bougainville, perhaps, or perhaps his own. By noon, the heavy casualties continued, but the threat of annihilation had vanished. 9,000 troops were ashore and counting. The Marines were on Iwo Jima to stay. Through the long afternoon, the American boys held their positions and even advanced, despite the continuing nightmare of fighting an invisible enemy. The Japanese crossfire maintained and even increased its prodigious volume. It came from everywhere on the island. Even the artillery near Kitano Point, nearly 5 miles to the north, was delivering shells in sheets. From the right flank of the plateau-like land on the eastern beaches came automatic weapons fire that swept back and forth. Advancing vehicles were blown up by aircraft bombs embedded in the sand as tank mines. Spider traps and caves linked to the tunneling system were everywhere. They gave the defenders countless places from which to pop up, fire, disappear, and surface again somewhere else. The veteran Marine who'd boasted to my father that he was experienced enough to dodge bullets had not dreamed of what he'd face. The difference between living and dying was sheer luck, many survivors said later. You were a target if you moved, and you were a target if you stayed in place. Some of General Kurabayashi's technical stratagems could almost have been lifted from the science fiction comic books the Marines had read as boys. Many recalled watching in horror as an orifice would reveal itself on the side of Suribachi, a yawning hole in what had appeared to be solid rock. From the hole, the muzzle of a massive gun would appear and discharge a heavy round. Before American artillery could fix on the hole, it would close again. A reinforced metal shield operated like a giant retractable garage door. And yet, as William Wayne recalled, we did what we were ordered to do. We worked our way across the center of that island with machine guns firing at us. We'd jump into a tank ditch for protection, and then our leader would yell, "Mine!" and we'd change direction. We'd blast pillboxes, secure them just like in training. But unlike in training, they'd come alive again and fire at us from the rear. But we made it. We completed that day's mission. We got across the island. 8 battalions were on shore by the afternoon, as were the tank battalions of 2 divisions and elements of 2 artillery battalions. Getting ashore proved more difficult as the day progressed, and not just because of the gunfire. John Gramling recalled that his Amtrak circled for hours in the offshore water. The boys tensed for an incoming shell. We couldn't get in because of the congestion, he said. When we hit the beach, there were stacks of bodies. Wesley Coon's track encountered bodies well before it hit the shoreline. They floated face down because of the air trapped in their backpacks, he said. One of the war correspondents aboard the ships, Robert Sherrod, watched the battle through binoculars. To him, the struggling tanks were like so many black beetles struggling to move on tar paper. At around 5 p.m., Sherrod made ready to board a landing craft to take him ashore. He met Keith Wheeler of the Chicago Times returning from the beach. "I wouldn't go in there if I were you," Wheeler advised him. "There's more hell in there than I've seen in the rest of the war put together." In the midst of this hell, Harlan was crawling through a trench in the late afternoon, leading a line of boys on all fours. Bill Rannis was directly behind him and collided with him when Harlan stopped abruptly. "We all looked to see what had stopped Harlan," Rannis recalled. He was staring at two legs attached to hips with no upper torso. He was just transfixed, staring silently. To William Wayne, also in the line, the legs were inanimate, something to put out of his mind and move on from. "I was in a survival mode," he said, "and seeing those legs didn't bother me at the time. But to Harlan, they were part of a person." He turned to me after a little while and said softly, "Why don't we bury him?" Variations on such encounters produced varieties of tortured etiquette. Roland Kiasen tumbled into a crater and nearly rolled over a Marine with his right arm blown off. "I felt silly," he recalled. "I didn't know what to say. What do you say to someone who has just lost his right arm?" Mike Strank had performed heroically, shepherding his boys throughout the day, but his grim fatalism had not left him. Aloise Biggs recalled taking a breather in a shell hole with him in the afternoon. In a matter-of-fact voice, Mike said, "This is my third campaign, and I'm not going to make it through this one." "I'd been through Bougainville," Biggs said, "and I didn't think much of it at the time." The corpsmen were catching hell along with everyone else. Cliff Langley, Doc's co-medic, was watching six of them in a circle conferring with one another. A shell landed in their midst. "That was the last of them," Langley said. By nightfall, the beachhead was secured. As the sun set, the shoreline grew even more grotesquely clogged with human bodies. Each Marine returning for supplies from the front brought a dead or wounded man with him. Their groans could be heard up and down the shore as darkness set in. Uncounted numbers of them died there, blasted by shells as they lay on their stretchers, waiting to be evacuated to the hospital ships. And still there remained work to be done, for the corpsmen especially. More injured, hundreds more, lay scattered throughout the field of battle. Doc, as senior corpsman for his unit, received reports and assigned help as best he could. A Company, which had landed first and made the heroic charge across to the western beach, was among the most devastated. "Your father sent me over there," Cliff Langley recalled. "Their corpsmen were gone and they needed help. They started the day with 250 boys and they were down to 37. They had paid the price for that 700-yard dash across the island." On arriving, Langley encountered eight walking wounded among the casualties. "They were suffering," he said, "and I gave them tags to identify them as casualties so they could be evacuated. They could have left and received Purple Hearts and held their heads high, but like the lieutenant shot through the jaw in the morning, none of them would go. They stood there, wounded and bleeding," Langley remembered, "but they refused to leave their buddies." The first night on Iwo Jima brought its own special horrors. The hellish red comets that had cut the pre-dawn blackness reappeared in the sky intermixed with streaks of white. Tracers, shells from the offshore destroyers, more than 10,000 rounds, phosphorus star shells to provide bursts of white light, searchlights to keep Suribachi illuminated, parachute flares that made a poof sound when they illuminated and then floated down slowly. These flares cast an especially eerie glow over the island. As they wafted downward in the wind, their back-and-forth motions made the shadows move and seem to come alive. To Danny Thomas, lying in his foxhole on his back, the night sky was a mesh of hot light, a net of crisscrossing fire. "It seemed like you could stick a cigarette up and light it," he said. The leaders of Spearhead hardly rested. Colonel Harry Liversedge moved his command post 200 yards nearer the front to be ready for the next morning's assault on the mountain. In the waters offshore, boats churn through the night, bringing in more of the living, taking away more of the dying. At the White House, President Roosevelt shuddered when told of Iwu's first day. It was the first time in the war, through good news and bad, that anyone had seen the president gasp in horror. The first day's fighting had claimed more than half as many casualties as the entire Guadalcanal campaign. 566 men killed ashore and afloat, and 1,755 wounded. 99 boys had suffered combat fatigue. The remaining troops lay as still as they could, trying to sleep, trying not to sleep. They had been trained to shoot any moving object as the enemy. The falling parachute flares illuminated everything. The shadows darted and slid. Any shadow might be a Japanese soldier crawling softly for the kill. One surgeon had established an operating theater in what he'd thought was a safe area. With sandbags and tarp, he'd fashioned a makeshift hospital. But as he tried to sleep that night, he heard what sounded like foreign voices below him. Was he dreaming? He dug his fingers into the soft ash and felt for evidence. His fingertips scraped something solid. The wooden roof of a reinforced cavern. The surgeon had built his hospital directly atop the enemy. Phil Ward remembered that the passwords for that night were based on American-made cars. Uttering Nash, Plymouth, Chevrolet, or Dodge at a crucial moment could make the difference between life and death. Late in the night, Ward recalls, a guy put a gun to my head and I forgot all the passwords. Somehow he was spared. The first day of the Battle of Iwo Jima had come to an end. There were 35 left to go. Chapter 8. D-Day Plus One. It is good that war is so horrible. Or we might grow to like it. Robert E. Lee. Rain greeted the boys of Easy Company as they awoke and looked out at Suribachi's great squat bulk on Tuesday, February 20th. Rain and cold gusts would lash them for the next 3 days. The surf, mercifully calm during the invasion, had risen with the night winds. It roiled and slammed its ugly gray foam onto the beach in 4-foot waves. Now the unloading of equipment would be hampered by more than enemy artillery, and the mood among the high command was grim. It became a fight against the sea, the surf, the volcanic ash, and the Japanese all joined in one colossal alliance against us, General Smith would lament in his memoirs. It had been a chilly, nerve-shattering night. From their position above the western beaches, Mike, Ira, Harlan, and the others could hear the mortar, rocket, and artillery fire from Japanese guns. It did not abate throughout the night. The shells wiped out 2 casualty stations on the assault beach, killing many already wounded men. The young Marines had spent the night braced for a banzai charge. General Smith had warned them to expect it. Such attacks, hordes of Isengorin rushing insanely through the darkness toward the bivouacked Americans, had been routine tactics in other Pacific Island battles. Although terrifying, these charges at least exposed the Japanese soldiers to the Marines' gun sights. Usually the attackers lost many more men than the defenders. "This is usually when we break their backs," Howland Mad Smith observed as he gave orders to prepare. But no attack came. This extension of Kurabayashi's coolly radical, fill the beach and then get them strategy, withstood the objections of the traditionalists beneath him. Instead, the mortar and big artillery shells continuing through the night killed more American boys than any banzai charge ever could. And the stealthy menace implied by the flare's eerie glow was real. Not all the shadows were phantoms. At around 2 a.m., a Japanese grenade had landed in Easy's midst and injured Ed Kurelik and Phil Chrisman. A weary Doc Bradley felt his way through the darkness on his hands and knees to treat the wounded, shouting his name so that he would not be shot as an enemy. Richard Wheeler recalled that Kurelik, a Chicago kid, was steamed that the Japanese had not played fair. "I heard somebody coming up the trench and hollered Studebaker," Kurelik fumed as Doc bound his wounds. "And then that Jap threw a hand grenade." The gray dawn illuminated the night's destruction. To the experienced correspondent Robert Sherrod, who thought he had seen all the worst that the Pacific campaign had to offer, it revealed nothing less than a nightmare in hell. His dispatch continued, "About the beach in the morning lay the dead. They died with the greatest possible violence. Nowhere in the Pacific have I seen such badly mangled bodies. Many were cut squarely in half. Legs and arms lay 50 feet away from any body." Thus, for some Marines who hours earlier had prayed for night, it was now the dawn that proved a blessing. The 28th Regiment, Harry the Horse Liversedge's outfit, had established itself across the narrow neck of the island, isolating Suribachi just a few hundred yards to the south. Now the 3,000 men of the 28th would begin their dangerous advance southward toward the volcano, while the other 33,000 Marines on the island would fight their way north across the island's main mass toward the airfields and the high fortified ground on the northern rim. The cost of taking Suribachi would be high, and the 28th braced itself for the grim assignment. Soon after sunrise on D-Day plus one, Colonel Liversedge positioned his 2nd and 3rd battalions to continue their assault on Mount Suribachi. Easy Company was not among these units. They were held in regimental reserve. Easy would retrace their steps of the day before, going eastward to position themselves in the 2nd Battalion area. There they would assume a backup position from where they could be rushed into the front lines. The covering bombardment erupted at first light. An airstrike screamed in with the dawn. Navy carrier planes looming out of the wet sky to slam the mountain with rockets, bombs, and napalm blobs. At 8:30, Harry the Horse gave the order to attack, and elements of the 2nd Battalion under Lieutenant Colonel Chandler Johnson and the 3rd Battalion under Lieutenant Colonel Charles Shepard moved out. As the Marines zigzagged their way through the rain toward Suribachi, shells from half-tracks and nearby U.S. destroyers lambasted the mountain. It had little impact on the subterranean enemy. Captain Severance committed Easy's 1st Platoon to the attack early in the day. The platoon leader, Lieutenant George Stoddard, was wounded and evacuated. The ground assault gained less than 75 yards through the morning, and those yards were earned the old-fashioned way, via flamethrowers, handheld guns, and demolitions. Around 11 a.m., Johnson sent a message to 5th Division headquarters, "Enemy defenses much greater than expected. There was a pillbox every 10 feet. Support given was fine, but did not destroy many pillboxes or caves. Groups had to take them step by step, suffering severe casualties." While the attack surged and then stalled, Easy Company, minus the 1st Platoon, continued to pick its way east, always with the mountain and its gunners looming not far away. Contact with the enemy was negligible, except in the case of one Marine from the 3rd Platoon, a blacksmith's son and bona fide eccentric from Montana named Don Rule. Rule had become something of the company oddball during training. He hated wearing a helmet, lectured his buddies that brushing one's teeth only wears them down, and made no secret that he'd had enough training. He was ready to fight. On D-Day, Rule had shown everyone that he was not kidding. Spotting a cluster of 8 Japanese who were fleeing their blown-up blockhouse, the boy charged them by himself, killing one with a bullet and another with a bayonet thrust. Now, at around 11:30 of D+1, Rule came loping up to Easy Company's 1st Sergeant, John Daskalakis, with an equally reckless notion. A Marine lay wounded about 40 yards forward of Easy's position, and Rule wanted permission to bring him in. Several other Marines and corpsmen had already tried this and were driven off, many with wounds by machine gun fire. Sergeant Daskalakis pointed this out to Rule and then told him to go ahead. "He jumped out of the tank trap we were in," Daskalakis recalled, "ran through a tremendous volume of mortar and machine gun fire, and made it to the wounded man's side. Then he half-dragged and half-carried him back." Rule rounded up an assistant and a stretcher and bore the man off, again through heavy fire, to the battalion aid station 300 yards away. Then he sprinted back to the platoon and took his place again. The beach was still hot. Unlike Normandy's beaches, which fell quiet after 24 hours, the Iwo Jima shoreline continued to absorb casualties for days. Corpsman Hector McNeil could never forget the sight of wounded boys on their stretchers being blown to bits by shells. Roy Paramore of Lufkin, Texas, saw Seabees and bulldozer operators killed as he himself unloaded supplies in the firestorm. Father Paul Bradley and his assistant Max Heffley were likewise exposed, preoccupied through the onslaught as they cared for the wounded. Max remembered in particular one young Marine who had stepped on a landmine. "We raised his blanket and saw his legs and one arm were just chopped meat. He wouldn't survive. But he just lay there, calmly smoking a cigarette." But up on the front lines, American boys were avenging these losses with a fury. Some of the fiercest of these boys were just that, kids barely out of childhood. Jacqueline Lucas was an example. He'd fast-talked his way into the Marines at 14, fooling the recruiters with his muscled physique and martinet style. He'd attended a military academy before signing up. Assigned to drive a truck in Hawaii, he had grown frustrated. He wanted to fight. He stowed away on a transport out of Honolulu, surviving on food passed along to him by sympathetic leathernecks on board. He landed on D-Day without a rifle. He grabbed one lying on the beach and fought his way inland. Now, on D+1, Jack and three comrades were crawling through a trench when eight Japanese sprang in front of them. Jack shot one of them through the head. Then his rifle jammed. As he struggled with it, a grenade landed at his feet. He yelled a warning to the others and rammed the grenade into the soft ash. Immediately, another rolled in. Jack Lucas, 17, fell on both grenades. "Luke, you're gonna die," he remembered thinking. Jack Lucas later told a reporter, "The force of the explosion blew me up into the air and onto my back. Blood poured out of my mouth and I couldn't move. I knew I was dying." His comrades wiped out the remaining Japanese and returned to Jack to collect the dog tags from his body. To their amazement, they found him not only alive but conscious. Aboard the hospital ship Samaritan, the doctors could scarcely believe it. "Maybe he was too damn young or too damn tough to die," one said. He endured 21 reconstructive operations and became the nation's youngest Medal of Honor winner, and the only high school freshman to receive it. When I asked him, 53 years after the event, "Mr. Lucas, why did you jump on those grenades?" he did not hesitate with his answer: "To save my buddies." In the midst of battle, the Marines buried their dead. Don Mayer, at 19, had never before touched a corpse. On this day, he dragged body after body out of the surf. Kids who drowned jumping from their Amtraks, or who had been hit just as they landed. Bob Schmidt of Appleton, Wisconsin, was part of Graves' registration. Like the Kissing Bandit, he'd grown up near Doc, but didn't know him. In later years, they would play golf together. His unit was supposed to go in on D-Day, but the beach was so full they didn't make it until 2 p.m. on D+1. "We spent 28 hours in that little Amtrak just circling around," Schmidt said. "It was torture. I would doze off and then be awakened by waves of seasickness. All you could see was the carnage of the landing craft being blown up on the beach." When Bob Schmidt finally went to work, he realized at once that this was a different sort of battle. "I had buried the dead on Saipan," he said, "but the difference was how mangled the bodies were. The Japanese were hitting us with higher caliber weapons than we had ever seen. On Saipan, each Marine was buried in an individual grave, but on Iwo Jima, we'd bulldoze a single grave 100 feet long, 10 feet wide. We didn't bury by grave, we buried by rows. We had surveyors plotting the markers." Chaplain Gage Hodling could never forget the bleak enormity of these mass burials. "We buried 50 at a time in bulldozed plots. We didn't know if they were Jewish, Catholic, or whatever, so we said a general committal. We commit you into the earth and the mercy of Almighty God." I buried 1,800 boys. At about 4 p.m. on D+1, Easy Company received its order to head for the front, with the 2nd and 3rd platoons, plus company machine gun squads supporting each platoon. Its mission was to relieve a unit that had been online for most of the afternoon and taken many casualties. The 2nd Battalion had clawed its way some 100 yards toward Suribachi. The winter sun, which had emerged from the clouds late in the day, had now sunk behind the mountain, and the Marines of Easy moved directly into its giant shadow. Many of the young boys were seized with the feeling that the mountain was looking at them. And in fact, it was, with thousands of eyes, those of the 22,000 Japanese who were barricaded under its surface. Arriving at the front at a running crouch, Richard Wheeler asked a rifleman flat on his stomach, "How's it going up here?" "We're getting shot to hell," snapped the shooter. Almost immediately, Easy was experiencing this truth firsthand. Kenneth Milstead, a second platoon buddy of Mike, Ira, Franklin, and Harlan, had just dropped into a shallow foxhole he'd dug when a shell landed beside him and blew him out again. Blood streamed from the embedded fragments in his face. "I could have been evacuated," Milstead recalled, "but the Japanese had pissed me off. I went from being scared to being angry. That was the day I became a Marine." Over the boys' heads, rounds from tanks and offshore destroyers slammed into the mountain. "Nothing but noise," Phil Ward recalled. Navy and Marine fighter planes angled in, plastering the steep flanks with napalm that burst in bright orange plumes. On the ground, under fire, my father prowled, his Unit 3 pouch slung over his shoulder, exposed, looking for wounded. "Our sick bay was just a rifle in the ground," recalled Dr. James Whitmire, the battalion surgeon. "Doc Bradley came in with another casualty, and since he had been out with the troops so much, I ordered him to rotate to the back and take a breather. He was tired, but he refused to stop. He said, 'I don't want to leave my men. I want to stay with them.' Then he went back to the fighting." It was a day of heroics and tragedy for Easy Company. Sometimes the two were almost inseparable. As the Marines pushed ever closer to the mountain's base, Lieutenant Ed Pinnell spotted 5 gravely wounded men in open terrain not far from him. They needed immediate rescue, but they lay under withering crossfire. Pinnell looked around for a solution. A few tanks were finally lumbering toward the field. The nearest was about 100 yards away. Lieutenant Pinnell took out for it on a dead run. Somehow, reaching it unscathed, he grabbed the telephone hanging on its side and guided its driver back to 2 of the wounded men. Mike, Harlan, Ira, and Franklin dashed to the pair, partly shielded by the tank's bulk, and pulled them into a trench. Pinnell directed the driver to back the tank until it straddled the men, who were then pulled inside through the escape hatch door. The lieutenant then guided another tank toward the other 3 wounded men and repeated the risky operation twice more. He received a Navy Cross for his valor. And Don Rule remained in a fighting mood. A large Japanese gun was in place about 75 yards from the company's right flank. A company next to Easy had taken 7 casualties in an attempt to rush and neutralize it. Now the toothbrush-hating Rule and a buddy came up to Lieutenant Keith Wells, the 3rd platoon leader, and offered their services. As dozens of their fellow Marines watched, the 2 boys sprinted across territory that had cost other American boys their lives. Reaching the big gun, they found its emplacement unoccupied. The 2 stayed in the emplacement beside the weapon through the night to prevent the Japanese from reoccupying it. Rooting in the darkness, Rule found a tunnel not far away. With no apparent thought that it might be occupied by extremely unfriendly tenants, the eccentric Montana boy crawled inside and explored its entire length with lighted matches. He discovered several woolen blankets and brought them back to his dumbfounded comrades. As Suribachi's shadow spread into general darkness, Easy Company dug in for another cold, sleepless night. The fatigued boys knew what lay in store when the winter sun rose again. They knew that in the morning their battalion would have to assault the mountain, and that they would be part of the assault force. Again, the star shells, the flares, and the searchlights conjured vast, jumping shadows on Suribachi's sides to bedevil the boys' night thoughts. As if to provide a soundtrack for those thoughts, a Japanese mortar shell hit an ammunition dump on the beach late in the night. The explosions continued for an hour. By the end of this day, the 4th and 5th Divisions controlled only 1.5 miles of the island. For this territory, the 5th Division had suffered some 1,500 casualties, and the 4th about 2,000. And still the Americans could not see their enemy, could see little evidence that they had inflicted casualties. For most of the young boys, it had not fully sunk in yet that the defenders were not on Iwu, they were in Iwu, prowling the 16 miles of catacombs. Psychologically, it was as though they were shooting at and getting shot by phantoms. And now, in the darkened land of the phantoms, in the madman's haunted house, the boys tried once again to sleep. Chapter 9. D-Day Plus 2. Some people wonder all their lives if they've made a difference. The Marines don't have that problem. Ronald Reagan. A storm lashed in from the ocean. Blasts of wind. The surf at 6 feet. But this was nothing compared to the hellstorm about to erupt on the southern neck of the island. At 8:30 a.m., a thin line of unprotected American boys would arise and rush directly at the most fortified mountain in the history of the world. Almost one-third of them would be killed or maimed, but not in vain. Their charge would mark the beginning of the end for impregnable Suribachi, and thus for Iwo Jima itself as a factor in the war. Soaked, cold, and fatigued, the Marines awoke and gazed toward the primitive mass of rock that held their fates. In the tense silence as first light broke, Easy Company lay poised for action on the 2nd Battalion's right flank. Easy faced a long, lethal gauntlet on the volcano's northeastern side. Dave Severance's boys would have to rush across 200 yards of open terrain toward the mountain's base with very little cover of any kind. The guns trained down on the 200 yards between the 28th Regiment and the mountain's base would soon make those yards the worst killing ground in the Pacific. Only after the battle would Americans grasp the full extent of what had been concentrated against them. Suribachi's interior had been hollowed out into a fantastical seven-story subterranean world, fortified with concrete revetments and finished off with plastered walls, a sewer system, and conduits for fresh air, electricity, water, and steam. As many as 1,300 Japanese soldiers and 640 Navy troops filled each of the various rooms and tunnels. They were armed with guns of every conceivable size and design. The terrain below this fortress, the ground between the Marines and the mountain, was not only barren of natural cover, it lay in the teeth of overlapping ground fire. At the mountain base stretched a welter of reinforced concrete pillboxes and infantry trenches. The firing ports of the pillboxes were angled so that the Japanese shooters could see one another and offer mutual support with their spewing machine guns. At a little after 7:30 a.m., the Marines' own artillery opened its earth-shattering barrage. Hot, friendly metal streaked low over the Marines' heads, splintering the rock on the side of the mountain. The boys on the perimeter ducked under the lethal salvos. Shrapnel was a fickle friend. "Ask for all of it," Harry the Horse had yelled at his operations officer. There was no reason to hold back. After this day, there would be no space between the Marines and the enemy to aim shells. The combat could be hand-to-hand. Toward the end of the barrage, 40 carrier planes screamed in low, drilling the mountain with rockets that exploded at an ear-splitting pitch. Some of the bombs landed a football field's length away from the crouching Marines. The planes pulled away. H-hour drew near. 8 a.m. The boys braced themselves with a cry of attack that might usher in their last moments on Earth. But no attack order came. The problem was tanks. Colonel Liversedge had expected several to arrive to cover the assault, but none had appeared. Rearming and refueling problems and Japanese mortar harassment had kept them pinned down. Harry the Horse delayed the assault until 8:15, hoping that at any moment the mechanized monsters would grind into view. Nothing. At 8:30, Colonel Liversedge made a harrowing decision. Despite the crucial absence of armor to cover the charging boys, he could afford to wait no longer. He gave the order to go. An electric current of pure terror pulsed across the regiment. The Marines could see that the tanks were not in the field. No tanks, no large, bulky shapes to protect the boys against fire from the pillboxes as they ran. No tanks, nothing but bodies against bullets. A certainty of death filled the air. No jaunty war cries came from the veterans. Richard Wheeler experienced a pang of utter hopelessness. I could feel fear dragging at my jowls. Lieutenant Keith Wells would later admit to a memory from his boyhood in his father's slaughterhouse. an awareness among the cattle as the doors closed behind them of what lay in store. And then the heroes of the day began literally to stand up and be counted. One of the first was Lieutenant Keith Wells of Easy Company's 3rd Platoon. Wells did not tell his men to follow him. He simply got to his feet, waved his gun toward the mountain, and began running. "I just thought it was pure suicide," he later recalled. His mute example stirred the troops. Behind him, hundreds of scared boys stood up, leveled their rifles, and advanced against the mountain. To the left of Wells's 3rd Platoon with Doc Bradley was Lieutenant Ed Pinnell's 2nd Platoon with Mike, Harlan, Ira, and Franklin, matching Wells's advance step by step. The mountain exploded back at them, a screaming death. Harlan, Doc, Ira, and Franklin swept forward with the rest of Easy Company in the vanguard of the attack. Immediately, Japanese shells and bullets began cutting the Americans down. Amidst the din, the air was cut with kids' strangled voices calling, "Corman! Corman!" Officers and enlisted men crumpled together under the hailstream of steel, were blown to bits, were machine-gunned where they crouched, were sliced open by hot shards. Clusters of men were raked and raked again. In Corporal Richard Wheeler's area, a mortar shell killed Corporal Edward J. Romero, an ex-paratrooper from Chicago. Wheeler dove into a crater and had scarcely recovered his wits when another shell exploded, ripping the future rider's left jawline apart. As the blood spurted, Corpsman Clifford Langley, who had treated a jaw wound on D-Day, hurried to Wheeler's side and applied compresses. Then Langley gave aid to a wounded man nearby. As he was closing his pouch and preparing to leave the crater, Wheeler's rifle in his hand, yet another mortar shell burst upon them. This one ripped Wheeler's left calf apart and drove shrapnel into Langley. The young corpsman ignored his own wounds and once again dressed Wheeler's laceration. Then they both realized that the shell had done its worst work on the wounded man nearby. Both his legs had been ripped open, and he lay on his stomach, conscious but slowly dying. It wasn't over yet. Now a fourth mortar hurtled in. It landed with a thump, a dud. Had it been live, it would have killed everyone near it. Corpsman Langley, his clothing now soaked with his own blood, once again methodically closed his pouch, grabbed Wheeler's rifle, and went on his way. William Wayne saw a bullet take a buddy's face off. "His teeth were just lying there," Wayne said. "If I'd thought about it at the time, it would have driven me crazy." Yesterday's heroes became today's dead. Don Rule's eccentric bravado finally got the better of him. It happened early on. Rule and his platoon guide, Sergeant Henry Hansen, were in the forefront of a charge that reached the brushy fringe of the mountain's base. They rushed past bunkers that had been blasted by the bombing, but soon found themselves at close quarters with active defenders. The two leaped atop a disabled pillbox and emptied their rifles into a cluster of Japanese who were hurling hand grenades. As they blasted away, a grenade clunked down between them. Eyewitnesses recall that Rule, who was near the roof's edge, could easily have slid over the side and escaped harm. But that was not his nature. He sized up Hansen's position, helplessly isolated near the center of the roof, and acted. With a shout of warning, "Watch out, Hank!" he flung himself on the charge. Sergeant Hansen recalled seeing the charge land, realizing he was trapped, flattening himself out, hoping the fragments would pass over me, and hearing Rule's warning almost in the same instant. "I heard the muffled explosion," Hansen said in his official report of the incident. "I pulled Rule off the bunker, but he was dead. I am positive that had it not been for the self-sacrifice of his life, I would have been killed or seriously wounded." Among the first to reach Rule's body was Doc Bradley, who held the dead boy in his arms while he examined him for signs of life. For his bravery, Don Rule received a posthumous Medal of Honor. The chain reaction of slaughter continued on. When Wheeler received his jaw wound, a comrade named Louis Adrian, a Spokane Indian, scrambled out of that foxhole and dove into another. There crouched his best buddy, Chick Robeson. The two Washington boys had enlisted together, traveled to Camp Pendleton together by train, and shared a tent in training. On Liberty in California one night, feeling no pain, they fell asleep on a beach. They awoke when a huge wave crashed over them. Now the two comrades were shoulder to shoulder, firing and tossing grenades, taking turns popping up and down in the cold, driving rain. "I came down to reload and Louis went up," Robeson recalled. "Then a bullet got him right in the heart. He fell and turned yellow with death. Louis was my best friend, my link with home. I was staring at him when our corporal yelled, 'Move, Chick! Move! Move!' And so 17-year-old Chick Robeson stood up and charged forward. He was a Marine, and he had work to do. The 2nd platoon, fighting hard on the left, found itself under a concentrated mortar barrage. Ira, Franklin, Harlan, and Mike zigzagged from one shell hole to another as they bore forward, looking for any sort of protection. Around them, their friends were suffering and dying as Easy took a cluster of casualties. A mortar round blew two boys to bits. An artillery round landed near Tex Stanton. The concussion blew Tex 10 feet in the air. He fell to earth with deep burns on his legs and hips. And still they advanced, even as their casualties mounted at a rate that would have caused panic and retreat in nearly any other attacking force. These Marines remembered their training at Camps Pendleton and Tarawa and kept moving forward. Stoically, they followed their assigned roles and maintained the intricate teamwork of the great assaulting organism. The riflemen and machine gunners who survived the charge aimed their fire at individual blockhouse ports, often mere slits in the hardened igloos. And as the enemy ducked, if the enemy ducked, the surviving demolition squads and the flamethrowers moved in through the chattering crossfire to get close enough for extermination. In the midst of the carnage, Doc Bradley ran through the chaos, doing what he could in this landscape of blood. Just 30 minutes into the charge, the wet terrain was strewn with American bodies. Now the peaceable newsboy ignored the bullets and tried to save lives. He watched a Marine blunder into a crossfire of machine gun bursts and slump to the ground. Doc did not hesitate, his telltale Unit 3 bag slapping at his side. My father sprinted through 30 yards of saturating crossfire, mortars and machine guns to the wounded boy's side. As bullets whined and pinged around him, Doc found the Marine losing blood at a life-threatening rate. Moving him was out of the question until the flow was stanched. The Japanese gunfire danced all around him, but Doc focused his mind on his training. He tied a plasma bottle to the kid's rifle and jammed it bayonet first into the ground. He moved his own body between the boy and the sheets of gunfire. Then, his upper body still erect and fully exposed, he administered first aid. His buddies watching him from their shell holes were certain that he would be cut down at any moment. But Doc Bradley stayed where he was until he thought it was safe to move the boy. Then he raised a hand, signaling his comrades not to help but to stay low, and then my father stood up into the merciless firestorm and pulled the wounded Marine back across the 30 yards to safety by himself. His attention did not flicker until the Marine was safely evacuated. This action, so heroic that 2 sergeants and Captain Severance came forward to report it, earned him his Navy Cross, an honor he never mentioned to our family. It was one of the bravest things my father ever did. And it happened on one of the most valorous days in the history of a corps known for valor. Among the many heroes on the field, none surpassed the sustained courage of Lieutenant Keith Wells, Don Rule's 3rd platoon leader, and the man who had stood up to inspire the initial charge. Wells took a terrific hit in the early fighting. It happened as Easy, slogging with ferocious intent toward the entrenched defenders, outpaced the unit on its right flank and began taking fire not only from the front but from the side as well. Soon the company was pinned down by grenades and bullets from a blockhouse in its path. Worse, it came under a pinpoint barrage of close-in mortar fire. 2 kids volunteered to the rear for more grenades. They were gunned down from the blockhouse. Flamethrowers Chuck Lindbergh and Robert Good rushed to the scene but could not get through the mortar fire to the emplacement. Then a shell burst near Lieutenant Wells, wounding him and 4 other men, including William Wayne. Wells suffered shrapnel wounds to his legs and lost some of his clothing. Doc Bradley darted to his side, injected him with morphine, and told him to get the hell to the rear. Wells would have none of it. His unit had begun the morning with 42 men. 25 now remained. No one could be spared. The feeling had returned to his legs, and he decided to stay in the field, in command. Lieutenant Wells's determination drove his men to new heights of valor. Lindbergh and Good arose with their deadly flamethrowers and, ignoring the sheets of fire directed at them, stalked toward the pillbox. Soon the two were squirting their molten fire streams in all directions. They not only incinerated dozens of Japanese, the smell of burnt flesh floated on the damp wind. Their liquid fire turned several pillboxes into infernos, causing Japanese ammunition to explode in great bursts. Chuck Lindbergh later recalled the hazards of lugging a tank that carried 72 pounds of jellied gasoline, napalm, under 1,200 pounds of pressure. The shot only lasted 6 seconds, he recalled. We fired in short bursts. It was dangerous work. A lot of guys bought the farm trying that. Lindbergh's steely calm and ferocious concentration led him to heights of accomplishment that few others attained. His day's work earned him a Silver Star. The roar of tank treads now competed with the din of artillery all along the Marines' front as dozens of them belatedly joined the front line. Shielded by the armored bulk, infantrymen could rush ever closer to pillboxes and bunkers without being exposed to fire. The inhabitants of those hovels, those who were not gunned down or scorched to death, began to flee toward the mountain. The Japanese first-line defenses were crumbling. But the price of this victory remained high, and heroes continued to suffer. Five of the flag raisers fought side by side, led by Lieutenants Wells and Pennell. And now Pennell himself was a lacerated casualty, needing rescue. He was dashing from shell hole to shell hole when a shell landed between his legs and blew him a distance of 30 feet. His left heel was blown off, his right buttock and thigh gouged out, and his left shin pierced by shrapnel. Half a century later, Pennell told the story with detached humor. I was semi-conscious. I heard someone screaming. Then I realized it was me. I felt liquid running down my butt, and I thought my life juices were running out. I looked between my legs to see what I had left. It was okay. It was my damaged canteen leaking. A medic came by and gave me a brandy and a shot of morphine. I took my helmet off and put it over my genitals. I laid there in a depression like a soup tureen for hours. Parts of my body blown off, no clothes, helmet over my privates. I laid there with everything exploding around me. An amphibious tractor tried to reach him. It hit a mine and blew up, killing the boys inside. Several hours later, four Marines approached him with a poncho. They rolled him onto it, each grabbed a corner, and they set off for the beach. A bullet wounded one of the carriers, and Pennell toppled heavily to the ground. The remaining three men dragged him to the beach. He lay there on a stretcher until darkness. I felt exposed, he said. Like I was on a platform for all to see. Those flat trajectory shells would skim straight in, making a roaring sound in the dark. Foom, foom, foom. Guys were being killed all around me. It was complete chaos. Finally, Lieutenant Pennell was loaded with some other wounded boys onto a long pallet. An Amtrak rushed them to an offshore hospital ship, where the pallets were hooked with wires and winched up to the main deck. A wire broke that was pulling the pallet just before mine, the lieutenant remembered. Those guys screamed and just sank to the bottom. Lieutenant Pennell's ordeal was not yet over. As a doctor examined him, a Japanese shell crashed onto the deck and skidded into the fuel bunker. The doctor turned and stood with his stethoscope pressed to the bunker, listening to the shell as it rolled around, doubtless wondering whether he and everyone nearby was about to be blown up. But it was a dud. It had been a long day, Ed Pennell told me later. Soaked with blood, nearly immobilized by pain, Keith Wells continued to direct the 3rd Platoon's attack through the late morning. But he grew weak. He fell once, dashing to elude gunfire, and reopened his festering wounds. Immediately Doc Bradley was at his side. Doc dosed him up with morphine again, meanwhile screaming, "Enough! Get out of here!" Wells willed himself to stay in the field another half hour, directing assault groups and rallying his men. Finally, half delirious with pain and confident of victory, he turned his command over to Platoon Sergeant Ernest Boots Thomas and made for an aid station in the rear. He got there by crawling. He was awarded a Navy Cross.
End of disc 6.